Good evening, friends, and welcome to Sleepy Tom Tales, a podcast aimed at helping you to get a good night's sleep. Do you find your mind plagued with the stresses of modern life, especially when the lights are out and you're trying to get a restful night? Does your spinning mind keep you awake? Follow my voice down the path towards a good night's rest. Listen to me tell a story that will keep your mind from wandering to your daytime problems, the ones you can't solve right now and will be easier to solve well rested. Listen to my voice and allow yourself to drift, following the twists and turns of the story, but slowly letting go and drifting into sleep. Before we get on with the show, I'd like to take a minute to ask for a bit of support. If you find Sleepy Tom Tales helpful, and you'd like to, and you'd help me to keep it ad-free and going out to thousands of insomniacs just like you, please consider supporting it on Patreon at patreon.com/sleepytimetales. This is a monthly support that not only helps me keep the lights on, but can also get you fun bonuses based on your contributions. From as little as $2 a month, you get weekly access to early release on the main episodes, so that you can get your fresh sleep aid on a Wednesday instead of a Sunday. And $5 gets you a whole bunch of stuff, including weekly bonus minisodes, currently poetry readings, I'm going through the work of George Eliot, special edits of the main episode, and a monthly megasode, which is all the month's releases in one big listen. The most recent member of the Patreon family is Lee, who signed up last week. Welcome to the team, Lee. I'm glad the podcast is useful to you, and I'm very grateful for your support. Thank you. Thanks for listening. But maybe a monthly support seems a big ask. Times are tough for a lot of people, and I do understand that. But if you'd like to help out, you can still make once-off tips through Buy Me a Coffee or buymeacoffee.com/sleepytimetales, or the tip jar on the website. I've also got some very basic merchandise up on a TeePublic store, which you can reach through the show notes or via the website sleepytimetales.net. But while money is helpful, after all, it's how I pay for the services that I use and let me buy stuff, it's even possibly more helpful to just spread the word. If you can help me in my mission to give more people a useful, restful night's sleep, that is more than I can even reasonably ask for. If there's someone in your life you think will benefit from listening to Sleepy Tom Tales, just tell them. And if you do it on social media, please make sure to tag me in at Sleepy Tom Tales on Instagram and Twitter so that I can see and I can say hi. Last but not least, I've got to give a shout out to the music, which is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiko. Their work is available on their website at loyaltyfreakmusic.com. Thanks for taking the time. Let's get back to the show. So what exactly is Sleepy Tom Tales? What is it for? What is the strange thing, the strange idea, this podcast that you're supposed to fall asleep to? But lack of sleep is a health crisis in the 21st century, and this is a podcast intended to help those that it can to get a restful night. Do you find yourself lying awake at night, mind spinning and emotions in turmoil with anxieties of 21st century life? Do you wake up in the middle of the night and find yourself not quite able to doze back off at 3 a.m.? I'm here to help. My name is Dave, and I'm your narrator, here to help you into a restful night. Sleepy Tom Tales is intended to be used as a distraction to what keeps you awake at night. Or sometimes just background noise or even company. That's why I make these episodes quite long, so that I'm here for you, without any pressure of the end coming. Now, as far as I know, there are a couple of different ways to engage with the show. The main idea behind Sleepy Tom Tales is that it gives you something to focus on, a story or an event that lets you keep your mind on a specific point, to stop it from spinning out into stress and anxieties, to focus just enough not to resist the embrace of a night's sleep. But maybe you need something a bit different. People these days sometimes just need some kind of background noise. Some kind of white noise, sound of the waves, sound of the wind in the trees, maybe just some boring dude droning on in the background. But however you're engaging with the show, whether you're actually paying attention or not, it's important that you don't try to force the sleep. Just keep a light mental grip on the thread of the tale and allow the need for sleep to come for you. Now I'm hoping that you're asleep before I get to the end of the episode, but don't feel pressurized. This may not work on the first night. It'll probably take a few nights for you to get used to listening to my voice. Maybe my accent is strange to you. Maybe one episode just isn't long enough. Or maybe your problem isn't going to sleep. Maybe your problem is waking up in the middle of the night. What I recommend, because it's what works for me, is to just let the podcast run all night. Playlist a whole bunch of episodes, or once you've downloaded them, enough to run through the whole night, and start at the latest and just let them go. This way, if you wake up at 3 a.m. or whatever time and find yourself staring at the ceiling, the stream is still running and you can pop your earbuds in and allow yourself to go straight back to sleep again. The same sort of thing counts if you wake up just before your alarm, 60 minutes or as little as 30 minutes, you can do the same thing. And it may seem strange, what's the point of another 30-minute sleep? But I've actually had people thank me for this, suggesting that they try that. Because for some reason, allowing yourself to relax right before the alarm is satisfying on a whole new, deep level. It's important, though, that you try to relax. If you're new to the show and prone to late nights lying staring at the ceiling, this may seem strange to you. So give it a chance. Because I'm here to work with you, to create a safe space, a cocoon in which you can curl up and allow nature to take its course. So if you're still with me, thank you for staying. If you're already asleep, we'll chat again soon. And of course you aren't hearing me, except maybe in a dream. We return to On the Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection by Charles Darwin. The doctrine of the origin of our several domestic races from several Aboriginal stocks has been carried to an absurd extreme by some authors. They believe that every race which breeds true, let the distinctive characters be ever so slight, has had its wild prototype. At this rate, there must have existed at least a score of species of wild cattle, as many sheep, and several goats in Europe alone, and several even within Great Britain. One author believes that there formerly existed in Great Britain 11 wild species of sheep peculiar to it. When we bear in mind that Britain has now hardly one peculiar mammal, and France but a few, distinct from those of Germany, and conversely, and so with Hungary and Spain, etc. But that each of these kingdoms possesses several peculiar breeds of cattle, sheep, etc., we must admit that many domestic breeds have originated in Europe. For whence could they have derived, as these several countries do not possess a number of peculiar species as distinct parent stocks? Even in the case of the domestic dogs of the whole world, which I fully admit have probably descended from several wild species, I cannot doubt that there has been an immense amount of inherited variation. Who can believe that animals closely resembling the Italian greyhound, the bloodhound, the bulldog, or Blenheim's spaniel, etc., so and all unlike wild Canidae, ever existed freely in a state of nature? It has often been loosely said that all our races of dogs have been produced by the crossing of a few Aboriginal species. But by crossing, we can get only forms of some degree intermediate between their parents. And if we account for our several domestic races by this process, we must admit the former existence of the most extreme forms, as the Italian greyhound, bloodhound, bulldog, etc., in the wild state. Moreover, the possibility of making distinct races by crossing has been greatly exaggerated. There can be no doubt that a race may be modified by occasional crosses, if aided by the careful selection of these individual mongrels, which present any desired character, but that a race could be obtained nearly intermediate between two extremely different species or races, I can hardly believe. Sir J. Sebright expressly experimentized for the subject and failed. The offspring from the first cross between two pure breeds is tolerably, and sometimes, as I have found with pigeons, extremely uniform. And everything seems simple enough. But when these mongrels are crossed with another for several generations, hardly two of them will be alike. And then the extreme difficulty, or rather utter hopelessness, of the task becomes apparent. Certainly a breed intermediate between two very distinct breeds could not be got without extreme care and long-continued selection. Nor can I find a single case, on record, of a permanent race having been thus formed. On the breeds of the domestic pigeon. Believing that it is always best to study some special group, I have, after deliberation, taken up domestic pigeons. I have kept every breed which I could purchase or obtain, and have been most kindly favoured with skins from several quarters of the world, more especially by the Honourable W. Elliot from China, and by the Honourable C. Murray from Persia. Many treatises in different languages have been published on pigeons, and some of them are very important, as being of considerable antiquity. I have associated with several eminent fanciers, and have been permitted to join two of the London pigeon clubs. The diversity of the breeds is something astonishing. Compare the English carrier and the short-faced tumbler, and see the wonderful difference in their beaks, entailing corresponding differences in their skulls. The carrier, more especially the male bird, is also remarkable from the wonderful development of the carunculated skin about the head, and this is accompanied by greatly elongated eyelids, very large external orifices to the nostrils, and a wide gape of mouth. The short-faced tumbler has a beak in outline, almost like that of a finch, and the common tumbler has the singular and strictly inherited habit of flying at a great height in compact flock, and tumbling in the air, head over heels. The runt is a bird of great size, with long massive beak and large feet. Some of the sub-breeds of runts have very long necks, others very long wings and tails, others singularly short tails. The barb is allied to the carrier, but instead of a very long beak, has a very short and very broad one. The pouter has a much elongated body, wings and legs, and its enormously developed crop, which it glories in inflating, may well excite astonishment and even laughter. The turbot has a very short and conical beak, with a line of reversed feathers down the breast, and has the habit of continually expanding slightly the upper part of the esophagus. The Jacobin has the feathers so much reversed along the back of the neck that they form a hood, and it has, proportionally to its size, much elongated wing and tail feathers. The trumpeter and laugher, as their names express, utter a very different coo from the other breeds. The fantail has 30 or even 40 tail feathers, instead of 12 or 14, the normal number in all members of the great pigeon family. And these feathers are kept expanded, and are carried so erect that in good birds the head and tail touch. The oil gland is quite aborted. Several other less distinct breeds might have been specified. In the skeletons of the several breeds, the development of the bones of the face in length and breadth and curvature differs enormously. The shape, as well as the breadth and length of the ramus of the lower jaw, varies in a highly remarkable manner. The number of the caudal and sacral vertebrae vary, as does the number of the ribs, together with their relative breadth and the presence of processes. The size and shape of the apertures in the sternum are highly variable. So is the degree of divergence and relative size of the two arms of the furcula. The proportional width of the gape of the mouth, the proportional length of the eyelids, of the orifice, of the nostrils, of the tongue, not always in strict correlation with the length of beak, the size of the crop and of the upper part of the esophagus, the development and abortion of the oil gland, the number of the primary wing and caudal feathers, the relative length of wing and tail to each other and to the body, the relative length of leg of the feet, and the number of scutellae on the toes, the development of skin between the toes, are all points of structure which are variable. The period at which the perfect plumage is acquired varies, as does the state of the down with which the nestling birds are clothed when hatched. The shape and size of the eggs vary. The manner of flight differs remarkably, as does in some breeds the voice and disposition. Lastly, in certain breeds, the males and females have come to differ to a slight degree from each other. Altogether, at least a score of pigeons might be chosen, which, if shown to an ornithologist and he were told that they were wild birds, would certainly, I think, be ranked by him as well-defined species. Moreover, I do not believe that any ornithologist would place touch. The oil gland is quite aborted. Several other less distinct breeds might have been specified. The English carrier, the short-faced tumbler, the runt, the barb, pouter, and fantail in the same genus. More especially as in each of these breeds, several truly inherited subbreeds, or species as you might have called them, could be shown him. Great as the differences are between the breeds of pigeons, I am fully convinced that the common opinion of naturalists is correct. Namely, that all have descended from the rock pigeon, Columba livia, including under this term several geographical races or subspecies, which differ from each other in the most trifling respects. As several of the reasons which have led me to this belief are in some degree applicable in other cases, I will here briefly give them. If the several breeds are not varieties, and have not proceeded from the rock pigeon, they must have descended from at least 7 or 8 aboriginal stocks. For it is impossible to make the present domestic breeds by the crossing of any lesser number. How, for instance, could a pouter be produced? By crossing 2 breeds, unless one of the parent stocks possessed the characteristic enormous crop. The supposed aboriginal stocks must all have been rock pigeons. That is, not breedingly or willingly perching on trees. But besides C. livia, with its geographical subspecies, only 2 or 3 other species of rock pigeons are known, and these have not any of the characters of the domestic breeds. Hence, the supposed aboriginal stocks must either still exist in the countries where they were originally domesticated, and yet be unknown to ornithologists, and this, considering their size, habits, and remarkable characters, seems very improbable. Or they must have become extinct in the wild state. But birds breeding on precipices and good flyers are unlikely to be exterminated. And the common rock pigeon, which has the same habits with the domestic breeds, has not been exterminated even on several of the smaller British islets, or on the shores of the Mediterranean. Hence the supposed extermination of so many species having similar habits with the rock pigeon seems to me a very rash assumption. Moreover, the several above-named domesticated breeds have been transported to all parts of the world, and therefore some of them must have been carried back again into their native country. But not one has ever become wild or feral. Though the dovecot pigeon, which is the rock pigeon in a very slightly altered state, has become feral in several places. Again, all recent experience shows that it is most difficult to get any wild animal to breed freely under domestication. Yet on the hypothesis of the multiple origin of our pigeons, it must be assumed that at least 7 or 8 species were so thoroughly domesticated in ancient times by half-civilized man as to be quite prolific under confinement. An argument, as it seems to me, of great weight, and applicable in several other cases, is that the above-specified breeds, though agreeing generally in constitution, habits, voice, colouring, and in most parts of their structure, with the wild rock pigeon, it is certainly highly abnormal in other parts of their structure. We may look in vain throughout the whole great family of Columbidae for a beak like that of the English carrier, or that of the short-faced tumbler or barb, for reversed feathers like those of the Jacobin, for a crop like that of the pouter, for tail feathers like those of the fantail. Hence it must be assumed not only that half-civilized man succeeded in thoroughly domesticating several species, but that he intentionally or by chance picked out extraordinarily abnormal species. And further, that these very species have since all become extinct or unknown. So many strange contingencies seem to me improbable in the highest degree. Some facts in regard to the colouring of pigeons well deserve consideration. The rock pigeon is of a slaty blue and has a white rump. The Indian subspecies, C. intermedia of Strickland, having it bluish. The tail has a terminal dark bar with the bases of the outer feathers externally edged with white. The wings have 2 black bars. Some domestic breeds and some apparently truly wild breeds have, besides the 2 black bars, the wings checkered with black. These several marks do not occur together in any other species of the whole family. Now, in every one of the domestic breeds, taking thoroughly well-bred birds, all the above marks, even to the white edging of the outer tail feathers, sometimes concur perfectly developed. Moreover, when 2 birds belonging to 2 distinct breeds are crossed, neither of which is blue or has any of the above specified marks, the mongrel offspring are very apt suddenly to acquire these characteristics. For instance, I crossed some uniformly white fantails with some uniformly black barbs, and they produced mottled brown and black birds. These again are crossed together, and one grandchild of the pure white fantail and pure black barb was of a beautiful blue colour, with the white rump, double black wing bar, and barred and white-edged tail feathers, as any wild rock pigeon. We can understand these facts on the well-known principle of reversion to ancestral characters, if all the domestic breeds have descended from the rock pigeon. But if we deny this, we must make one of the 2 following highly improbable suppositions. Either, firstly, that all the several imagined Aboriginal stocks were coloured and marked like the rock pigeon, although no other existing species is thus coloured and marked, so that in each separate breed there may be a tendency to revert to the very same colours and markings. Or secondly, that each breed, even the purest, has within a dozen, or at most within a score of generations, been crossed by the rock pigeon. I say within a dozen or 20 generations, for we know of no fact countenancing the belief that the child ever reverts to some one ancestor, removed by a greater number of generations. It is a breed which has been crossed only once with some distinct breed. The tendency to reversion to any character derived from such cross will naturally become less and less, as in each succeeding generation there will be less of the foreign blood. But when there has been no cross with a distinct breed, and there is a tendency in both parents to revert to a character, which has been lost during some former generation, this tendency, for all that we can see to the contrary, may be transmitted, undiminished, for an indefinite number of generations. These two distinct cases are often confounded in treatises on inheritance. Lastly, the hybrids or mongrels from between all the domestic breeds of pigeons are perfectly fertile. I can state this from my own observations, purposely made on the most distinct breeds. Now it is difficult, perhaps impossible, to bring forward one case of the hybrid offspring of two animals, clearly distinct, being themselves perfectly fertile. Some authors believe that long-continued domestication eliminates the strong tendency to sterility. From the history of the dog, I think there is some probability in this hypothesis. If applied to species closely related together, though it is unsupported by a single experiment. But to extend the hypothesis so far as to suppose that species, aboriginally as distinct as carriers, tumblers, pouters, and fantails now are, should yield offspring perfectly fertile, inter se, seems to me rash in the extreme. From these several reasons, namely the improbability of man having formerly got 7 or 8 supposed species of pigeons to breed freely under domestication, these supposed species being quite unknown in a wild state, and their becoming nowhere feral, these species having very abnormal characters in certain respects, as compared with all other Columbidae, though so like in most other respects to the rock pigeon, the blue colour and various marks occasionally appearing in all the breeds, both when kept pure and when crossed. The mongrel offspring being perfectly fertile. From these several reasons, taken together, I can no longer doubt that all our domestic breeds have descended from the Columbia livia with its geographical subspecies. In favour of this view, I may add, firstly, that C. livia, or the rock pigeon, has been found capable of domestication in Europe and in India, and that it agrees in habits and a great number of points of structure with all the domestic breeds. Secondly, although an English carrier or short-faced tumbler differs immensely in certain characters from the rock pigeon, yet by comparing the several sub-breeds of these breeds, more especially those brought from distant countries, we can make an almost perfect series between the extremes of structure. Thirdly, those characters which are mainly distinctive of each breed, for instance the wattle and length of beak of the carrier, the shortness of that of the tumbler, and the number of tail feathers in the fantail, are in each breed eminently variable. And the explanation of this fact will be obvious when we come to treat of selection. Fourthly, pigeons have been watched and tended with the utmost care and loved by many people. They have been domesticated for thousands of years in several quarters of the world. The earliest known record of pigeons is in the 5th Egyptian dynasty, about 3000 BC, as was pointed out to me by Professor Lepsius. But Mr. Birch informs me that pigeons are given in a bill of fare in the previous dynasty. In the time of the Romans, as we hear from Pliny, immense prices were given for pigeons. Nay, they are come to this pass that they can reckon up their pedigree and race. Pigeons were much valued by Akbar Khan in India about the year 1600. Never less than 20,000 pigeons were taken with the court. The monarchs of Iran and Turan sent him some very rare birds, And, continues the courtly historian, His Majesty, by crossing the breeds, which method was never practiced before, has improved them astonishingly. About this same period, the Dutch were as eager about pigeons as they were the old Romans. The paramount importance of these considerations in explaining the immense amount of variation which pigeons have undergone will be obvious when we treat of selection. We shall then also see how it is that the breeds so often have a somewhat monstrous character. It is also a most favorable circumstance for the production of distinct breeds, that male and female pigeons can be easily mated for life, and thus different breeds can be kept together in the same aviary. I have discussed the probable origin of domestic pigeons at some, yet quite insufficient length, because when I first kept pigeons and watched the several kinds, knowing well how true they bred, I felt fully as much difficulty in believing that they could ever have descended from a common parent as any naturalist could in coming to a similar conclusion in regard to the many species of finches or other large groups of birds in nature. One circumstance has struck me as much, namely, that all the breeders of the various domestic animals and the cultivators of plants with whom I have ever conversed, or whose treatises I have read, are firmly convinced that the several breeds to which each has attended are descended from so many aboriginally distinct species. Ask, as I have asked, a celebrated raiser of Hereford cattle, whether his cattle might not have descended from longhorns, and he will laugh you to scorn. I have never met a pigeon, or poultry, or duck, or rabbit fancier, who was not fully convinced that each main breed was descended from a distinct species. Van Mons, in his treatise on pears and apples, shows how utterly he disbelieves that the several sorts, for instance a Ribston pippin or codlin apple, could ever have proceeded from the seeds of the same tree. Innumerable other examples could be given. The explanation, I think, is simple. From long-continued study, they are strongly impressed with the differences between the several races. And though they well know that each race varies slightly, for they win their prizes by selecting such slight differences, yet they ignore all general arguments and refuse to sum up in their minds slight differences accumulated during many successive generations. May not these naturalists who, knowing far less of the laws of inheritance than does the breeder, and knowing no more than he does of the intermediate links in the long lines of descent, yet admit that many of our domestic races have descended from the same parents? May they not learn a lesson of caution when they deride the idea of species and a state of nature being lineal descendants of other species? Selection. Let us now briefly consider the steps by which domestic races have been produced, either from one or from several allied species. Some little effect may perhaps be attributed to the direct action of the external conditions of life, and some little to habit. But he would be a bold man who would account by such agencies for the differences of a dray and a racehorse, a greyhound and bloodhound, a carrier and a tumbler pigeon. One of the most remarkable features in our domesticated races is that we see in them adaptation. Not indeed to the animals or plants' own good, but to man's use or fancy. Some variations useful to him have probably arisen suddenly, or by one step. Many botanists, for instance, believe that the Fuller's teasel, with its hooks, which cannot be rivaled by any mechanical contrivance, is only a variety of the wild Dipsicus, and this amount of change may have suddenly arisen in a seedling. So it has probably been with the turnspit dog, and this is known to have been the case with the Ancon sheep, But when we compare the dray horse and racehorse, the dromedary and camel, the various breeds of sheep fitted either for cultivated land or mountain pasture, with the wool of one breed good for one purpose and that of another breed for another purpose, when we compare the many breeds of dogs, each good for man in very different ways, when we compare the game cock, so pertinacious in battle, with other breeds, so little quarrelsome, with everlasting layers, which never desire to sit, and with the bantam, so small and elegant, when we compare the host of agricultural, culinary, orchard, and flower garden races of plants, most useful to man at different seasons and for different purposes, or so beautiful in his eyes, we must, I think, look further than to mere variability. We cannot suppose that all breeds were suddenly produced as perfect and as useful as we now see them. Indeed, in several cases, we know that this has not been their history. The key is man's power of accumulative selection. Nature gives successive variations. Man adds them up in certain directions useful to him. In this sense, he may be said to make for himself useful breeds. The great power of this principle of selection is not hypothetical. It is certain that several of our eminent breeders have, within a single lifetime, modified to a large extent some breeds of cattle and sheep. In order fully to realize what they have done, it is almost necessary to read several of the many treatises devoted to the subject and to inspect the animals. Breeders habitually speak of an animal's organization as something quite plastic, which they can model almost as they please. If I had space, I could quote numerous passages to this effect from highly competent authorities. Ewart, who was probably better acquainted with the works of agriculturalists than almost any other individual, and who was himself a very good judge of an animal, speaks of the principle of selection as that which enables the agriculturalist not only to modify the character of his flock, but to change it altogether. It is the magician's wand, by means of which he may summon into life whatever form and mould he pleases. Lord Somerville, speaking of what breeders have done for sheep, says, "It would seem as if they have chalked out upon a wall a form perfect in itself, and then had given it existence." That most skilful breeder, Sir John Sebright, used to say, with respect to pigeons, that he would produce any given feather in 3 years, but it would take him 6 years to obtain head and beak. In Saxony, the importance of the principle of selection in regard to merino sheep is so fully recognized that men follow it as a trade. The sheep are placed on a table and are studied like a picture by a connoisseur. This is done 3 times at intervals of months, and the sheep are each marked and classed so that the very best may ultimately be selected for breeding. What English breeders have actually effected is proved by these enormous prices given for animals with a good pedigree, and these have now been exported to almost every quarter of the world. The improvement is by no means generally due to crossing different breeds. All the best breeders are strongly opposed to this practice, except sometimes among closely allied subbreeds. And when a cross has been made, the closest selection is far more indispensable, even than in ordinary cases. If selection consisted merely in separating some very distinct variety and breeding from it, the principle would be so obvious as hardly to be worth notice. But its importance consists in the great effect produced by the accumulation in one direction, during successive generations, of differences, absolutely unappreciable by an uneducated eye. differences which I, for one, have vainly attempted to appreciate. Not one man in 1,000 has accuracy of eye and judgment sufficient to become an eminent breeder. If gifted with these qualities, and he studies a subject for years, and devotes his lifetime to it with indomitable perseverance, he will succeed, and may make great improvements. If he wants any of these qualities, he will surely fail. Few would readily believe in the natural capacity and years of practice requisite to become even a skillful pigeon fancier. The same principles are followed by horticulturalists, but the variations are here often more abrupt. No one supposes that our choicest productions have been produced by single variation from the aboriginal stock. We have proofs that this is not so, in some cases, in which exact records have been kept. Thus, to give a very trifling instance, the steadily increasing size of the common gooseberry may be quoted. We see an astonishing improvement in many florists' flowers, when the flowers of the present day are compared with drawings made only 20 or 30 years ago. When a race of plants is once pretty well established, the seed raisers do not pick out the best plants, but merely go over their seed beds and pull up the rogues, as they call the plants that deviate from the proper standard. With animals, this kind of selection is in fact also followed, for hardly anyone is so careless as to allow the worst animals to breed. In regard to plants, there is another means of observing the accumulated effects of selection, namely by comparing the diversity of flowers in the different varieties of the same species in the flower garden, the diversity of leaves, pods or tubers, or whatever part is valued, in the kitchen garden, in comparison with the flowers of the same species, and the diversity of fruit of the same species in the orchard, in comparison with the leaves and flowers of the same set of varieties. See how different the leaves of the cabbage are, and how extremely alike the flowers. How unlike the flowers of the heartsease are, and how alike the leaves. How much the fruit of the different kinds of gooseberries differ in size, color, shape, and hairiness. And yet the flowers present very slight differences. It is not that the varieties which differ largely in some one point do not differ at all in other points. This is hardly ever, perhaps never, the case. The laws of correlation of growth, the importance of which should never be overlooked, will ensure some differences. But as a general rule, I cannot doubt the continued selection of slight variations, either in the leaves, the flowers, or the fruit, will produce races differing from each other chiefly in these characters. And I think I'm going to leave it there. As always, if you want to pick this up, you can find it on Project Gutenberg at the link in the show notes. Thanks again for joining me on this episode of Sleepy Town Tales, the podcast designed around a bedtime story to help you to get a restful night. New episodes will be released every Sunday night to give you something fresh to help you rest in a new week, but make sure to subscribe in whatever service you use so that you get the new episodes whenever they come out. A reminder that the music for tonight is Sweet Night and Friends by Kumiku. Check out more of their work on their website, which you'll find linked in the show notes. Good night, and sweet dreams.